You're listening to Audio Culture on 95BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
Come in, Russell Brown. You there?
Kia ora. Yes, I am.
Okay, awesome. Zoom is working.
Excellent.
And we're ready to get into it. Firstly, obviously a massive congratulations to Doug Hood, who got, is it Merit of Order?
Officer of the New Zealand Order of Merit.
Okay.
It's actually won from the MNZM. So, yeah, it's a good recognition. And I guess I'd say what I said in the listener this week is that the honours lists are always full of people that we haven't heard of. And often that's because people who've spent their lives making it possible for others to shine. And Doug is absolutely that guy.
One of those people. Mike Havoc was up here a week or two ago when the news had just come out that Doug Hood was receiving this. And he was stoked. He was like, what a good bastard. He just had nothing but kind words to say about Doug Hood. So I guess, I mean, I feel like Mike Havoc's a pretty good judge of character. And Jin?
Yeah. No, mate, they were mates, but basically that's what everyone will say to you about Doug. Audio Culture did, when Doug's health wasn't looking too good last year, published a big, long list of tributes from people who knew Doug and had worked with him. And basically everyone paid tribute to his good nature, his kindness, and his even temper. Doug was often the guy who didn't panic and just got the thing done. Mm. Cultural and creative movements kind of need those people. They need the people who can say, oh, shit, that needs doing. Oh, I guess I'd better do it.
Mm-hmm.
And right from the beginning, that's kind of what Doug did.
Mm. Where did he start out? obviously, I've had a browse of the Audio Culture articles, but I guess it starts down south with Toy Love and Chris Knox.
Yeah. Doug actually grew up in Te Kuiti, but he moved to Dunedin and had been a student and then was working as a post office technician when his friend Chris Knox decided that he was going to form a band, which was The Enemy, who weren't, in a way, The Enemy weren't really a punk band. They were kind of punk inspired or liberated by punk. But they probably wouldn't have got very far if it wasn't for Doug, because Doug was a post office technician. So he had the training, which he used to put together a PA and drive it.
Mm-hmm.
And then because there wasn't someone to look after the money and drive the van, because, you know, Chris certainly wasn't capable of any of that, Doug did that too, and he kind of became their manager. And you look through his whole career and it's a matter of, oh, well, I'll do it.
Yes.
You know, and Roger Shepherd has a great story about driving down from Christchurch to see The Enemy, and he was supposed to be on the door, and it was $2 on the door. It was that long ago. And his name wasn't there, so he had to pay his $2. And that actually left him short of petrol money. So he was deeply grateful to Doug afterwards for remembering and coming up to him and giving him his $2.
Yeah.
So that, you know, it's that guy basically.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's Jin from the Tuesday 1-4 here, Russell. Hey,
hello.
I mean, back in that day, he was doing it certainly not with illusions of grandeur of making loads of cash from the music industry, was he? He was doing it purely for the love and getting things done, I imagine, in those sorts of
scenarios. Oh, absolutely, yeah. There was no money to be made, and it was kind of a lull between, on the one hand, you had some of the hairier, weirder bands, but the music industry itself was still coming out of basically its light entertainment period.
Yes, right.
Most of the names you knew were on Happening or Come On or something
like that.
So
a variety show kind
of thing. There wasn't really a structure in place for what the early Flying Nun bands in particular were trying to do. And that was actually a problem for a very long time. There was a management deficit. No one knew how to do any of this stuff.
Yes.
And it was often Doug who worked it out and did it. You know, things like copyright. and publishing.
Yeah.
No one knew any of that.
How do you figure that out at the time? Like, they'd just been...
Because it kind of would have been a closed shop. They wouldn't have wanted sort of, you know, musicians knowing too much as well, you know what I mean? Like, Doug Hood kind of almost advocating on behalf of musicians getting paid a fair amount.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I remember after I'd moved up to Auckland and started working for Rip It Up, I went to a meeting of independent music people talking about copyright, and Doug was there, and it became quite clear that no one really knew how it worked. But there were also things like mastering. You know, people started to realise, and certainly Chris Knox realised, that if you actually accompanied your record down to the pressing plant in Wellington and sat there and talked to the mastering engineer about how you wanted it to sound, then you were probably going to get a much better result. Yes, but that was all a learning experience.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Russell, you've selected a song from The Enemy. What can you tell us about Pull Down the Shades?
Pull Down the Shades, people might know as a toy love song, because they played it too and recorded it on the album that the band ended up hating. But this is one of The Enemy songs that passed on to Toy Love, and it's apparently, I just found it on YouTube, live at the Beneficiaries Hall, where they often played in Dunedin. A lot of these gigs were in funny little halls.
Right. Union halls and trade halls kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And beneficiaries in this case, I suspect, did not mean unemployed people. It meant the beneficiaries of a friendly society.
Yes.
But those were the places that you could hire. This is... I think people who know the song, the Toy Love version, will enjoy this. It's Pull Down the Shades. Let's play it. And it's Raw Glory.
Yes.
Okay. One of the gold melodies, Pull Down the Shades, before my voice goes.
Song to
Russell, can you give us a year on that one?
1978.
Wow. 78,
wow. Man,
I have no idea how this has turned up on the YouTube account that's on, but, yes. but it's there. So,
I mean, what an incredibly fertile time for music in New Zealand this era.
Yeah, yeah. It really kicked off. It became something new. And the funny thing about the Enemy is they were only around about a year, and then what the Enemy became, which was Toy Love, who I saw, I think, three or four times before I was old enough to actually get into pubs, because they played other venues as well. And they were only around for about 18 months. But it seemed like this epic period. It really did. And then they went to Australia. That didn't go very well for them. Doug apparently always thought it was a bad idea, but went with them anyway. They made an album where all their energy you just heard was really taken out of it. You know, the Toy Love album, the songs are great. It just doesn't sound...
And where was that recorded, Russell? Was that recorded...
It was recorded in Australia.
Right.
And the big studio producer made them turn everything down. Yes. And that actually... And Doug was there for that. And that actually had a really big impact on what happened next.
Okay.
Which was that they went, we don't want to work in big studios for big labels anymore. They had been on Warner. And Chris Knox got an inheritance from his grandmother, $400, and bought the famous four-track Teac tape machine. If you went to the Volume exhibition a few years ago at Auckland Museum,
yes,
that was there inside a glass case. And rightly so. That was what was used to make the Clean's Boodle Boodle Boodle. And Doug, you know, Chris Knox was there, always with the aesthetic input, but it was Doug at the controls, and he'd become quite a good live sound engineer by that point. So that ear is what actually informs Boodle, which sounds amazing still these, you know, now.
Geez,
it still sounds like a really well-recorded record, and it was recorded in that funny little hall on Bond Street.
Yeah, right.
On a four-track. It wasn't actually the first one. The first thing recorded on the four track was the Tall Dwarf's first EP, which was pre-Flying Nun. That was on a label called Furtive that Simon Gregg and Paul Rose ran. And Doug's account is that they didn't actually even have a mixer,
because just going straight in.
How to do this stuff. They just plugged everything.
How does
the
volume sound in the room, kind of thing?
Yeah.
And I think we've got that lined up to play, and it might really be worth playing because this sounds amazing too. And it became, this aesthetic actually became really influential a few years later in the American indie scene. And Chris was lauded as the, you know, as the founder of the lo-fi movement. And you know, Chris always insisted that low-tech was a better term. And he kind of had a point, because it doesn't sound terrible.
No.
It sounds great and very direct.
Yes.
But yeah, Tall Dwarfs, Nothing's Gonna Happen, I think. Should we listen to that?
Yes,
please.
I reckon.
Yeah, totally.
Say one word for anything but what they've learned from all the uncles. Race horses laugh so hopeful, stiff bricks in the general direction. I'm anywhere but home. Nothing's gonna happen. Maybe all the children in small rooms will fall silent at a wall, a window, and forget to breathe for just 1 minute because of some beauty that has not been altered, damned, or pointed out by the clumsy dark oafs will train them. Nothing's gonna happen. 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 Then again, all the time, every minute, never ending, unrelenting, all around us, without pausing, endless, endless, all pervading, moving motion, this way, that way, that way, our way. Tick tock, free fall, love, love, kiss, kiss, make, do, be, is, was, I, me, be. Nothing's gonna happen. Maybe all the children in small rooms will go silent in a wall or window and begin to breathe for just 1 minute because of some beauty that has not been altered and or pointed out. Then a clumsy dog will train them.
You've just joined us. We've got Russell Brown on the line from Audio Culture. We're chatting about Doug Hood's impacts on music in Aotearoa. Are you there, Russell?
Yes, I am indeed.
What's next? Where are we headed next?
We should probably move on because there were quite a few other records that Doug made on that four track. But the next way that Doug was important was in the live scene. He got a job with a PA company called Live Sound, and they put him on the Windsor Castle job. So he ran the PA there every time a band played.
Windsor Castle, refresh your listeners where that was.
Windsor Castle, a really, really vital music venue in, of all places, Parnell. And that became the place that all the Flying Nuns bands would come up to and play at, especially after Doug not only ran the PA but started booking the place.
Lord, do we need that in 2023, Parnell?
Oh, absolutely. But because he knew how that worked, and that moved on to he was the one who knew how touring worked. So he would start organising package tours for these bands, and you had the Looney Tour in 1984. Chills, Children's Hour, Double Happies, and The Expendables. And that the name for the Looney Tour came from Chris Knox, who was a big Looney Tunes fan.
Yes.
And
I was a child at this time. I was a 13-year-old at this time. Sorry to interrupt, Russell. And I remember seeing that in Rip It Up magazine. So it's formative in my years as well. I was too young to go to those gigs, but I remember it as being part of New Zealand music history, seeing those bands
ads. Yeah, and it had the Looney Tunes theme poster. Yeah. Funny thing is that when Doug decided to form a band, form a touring company, because he thought he might as well formalise it. He'd already organised the Fall and the birthday party to come to New Zealand. So it was like, okay, let's have a touring company. And he was going to call it Tally Ho Tours, as a nod to, of course, the Clean's first single. But it turned out there was a branding clash with a caravan company, so Looney Tours was born. And you've got this
apt for New Zealand music
generation
probably.
of bands that Doug brought over. Violent Femmes, Billy Bragg, New Order, John Cale, Nico, all the Australian bands like the Go-Betweens and the Hoodoo Gurus.
Mm.
That was all Doug.
Mm.
And it began with, like, yeah, typically coming back to this theme of, well, someone's got to.
Yes.
He'd never toured a foreign band before, but the birthday party wanted to play here. So Doug did that tour. And that was how he got into bringing artists to New Zealand.
Wow.
And that was a pretty wild start because the birthday party were falling apart at that point.
Mm.
There were rental cars strewn left all over the country. Afterwards, you know? it was a very, very strange and wild tour. And I guess you probably needed someone calm like Doug there. Otherwise, it could have just turned into chaos. And actually, the lovely thing about when he started bringing those bands over, he'd go and pick them up in his dungaree old car. And these bands, you know, bands like the Violent Femmes, would actually spend quite a bit of time at the house in Ponsonby in Summer Street where Doug lived with Chris Knox and Barbara Ward.
Right.
The Violent Femmes were introduced to One Day Cricket by Doug and became huge fans.
Great. Yes. Doug.
There was a series on against Servant
for New Zealand music, sport as well.
Yeah, exactly. So that was kind of remarkable. The next phase, because he'd made the connection with the Australian promoters Ken West and Vivian Lees, then in I think 1994 he picked up this festival they'd been doing called the Big Day Out.
Wow!
Wow!
And it was Doug that did that.
Yes.
As well.
Yes.
So you've got another generation of people discovering music because Doug did it.
Hmm.
I can't remember exactly how many years he did the Big Day Out. He did move on from that eventually, but that's a monumental heritage. Really.
Oh, it's just massive. I was saying to Johnny off air before about how crucial that was, you know, at the time, because, you know, you've got some massive promoters in Australia particularly, but you know, that he could bring those bands over, I think purely from an outsider perspective, was because he had a true love of music and the underground, the alternative and the indie, and seeing that there is an audience for this stuff that everybody had overlooked before.
Yeah, exactly. And also because I think people like working with Doug because he was trustworthy and level-headed.
Yeah.
He understood the music and... there's a lot of people running around doing stupid things because that's what we do in young music scenes. Yes. And then you've got Doug who's got it all together and is organising things.
Mm-hmm.
That level of trust, I think, is a testament to the way that Doug went about stuff.
Yeah.
All right, Russell. I feel like we're nudging up to the 6 o'clock news here. But
now,
this is...
I would say if we're going to play one more, play the Chills, and I'll explain why.
Yes.
And should we talk after that, or should we go out?
I reckon you say a piece and we'll go out on some music.
Okay. I think of all the bands that Doug worked with, the Chills were the one that was really important to him. He really believed in what Martin was doing, and they really wouldn't have, you know, they were the first of that generation of bands to leave New Zealand and play. They went to the UK in, I think, 84. And without Doug, huge deal. That would not have happened. And they didn't record I Love My Leather Jacket there, but they made the video for it on the London Underground, which is the kind of thing you do.
I love the video.
Yeah. And just finally, before we play that, I mentioned that we were all very worried about Doug's health last year. He's in much better shape now. You know, he's still cracking jokes.
Great.
He can't talk very well. I'll never get to hear the legendary Doug Hood tenor. He actually sang with the Clean, and apparently he had perfect pitch, but he kept it pretty quiet. And I guess the other thing to say about Doug is that, you know, the Flying Nun phenomenon was always seen as a musical movement that was about Pākehā kids getting in touch with their inner Celt or something like that.
Mm.
But Doug, like Shane Carter and Grant Felt and Headless Chickens, was an influential Māori figure within that. And it's not often recognised. Mm. I mean, like other people of his generation, he's 70 years old this year, he lost touch with his iwi affiliation, but he's part of the Flavel Whakapapa, which has its roots in Ngāpuhi. And I think that's a really good thing to recognise, that that there were these people there, and it wasn't just this pure white kid thing. That these really influential figures within it had their own Māori heritage, even if they were quite estranged from it, you know. Just Doug Hood, big up, basically.
Great. Awesome. Shout out Doug Hood and Russell Brown. Thank you so much for Audio Culture this evening. Head along to audioculture.co.nz. Pretty easy to find a couple of fantastic articles on Doug Hood people for you to buff up on your music history. All right. Cheers, lovely. Russell.
Cheers.
On 95BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz. It's just fascination.